It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Reporters from three Wisconsin news outlets are teaming up to investigate police accountability here in the state.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, WTMJ, and Wisconsin Watch are working together to uncover the Milwaukee County District Attorney's list of police officers it views as unreliable witnesses in court cases.
It's known as a Brady list. Prosecutors across the state have their own list to track which officers they shouldn't rely on for testimony because of past misconduct.
We're learning more about how these lists work and how these Wisconsin reporters are investigating them.
Ashley Luthern is the deputy investigations editor at the Journal Sentinel and an investigative reporter focused on public safety, crime, and policing. Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And Rachel Moran is an associate professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, where she researches Brady lists and police accountability. Rachel, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Ashley, I gave a very brief overview, but can you tell us a little more about what these so-called Brady lists are?
Absolutely. The Brady list is a list of law enforcement officials who have been found to have lied or broken the law or acted in a way that erodes their credibility or integrity to be a witness. As you mentioned, it's it comes from a U.S. Supreme Court case, Brady versus Maryland. And that ruled that very generally that prosecutors can't withhold material that might help the defense at trial or exculpatory evidence. And that includes any indication that an essential witness, such as a police officer, might have credibility issues.
Rachel, can you talk a little more about why these lists exist? What was the reasoning behind that decision and how it's been implemented that Ashley was just talking about?
Yeah, so the reason these lists exist is that the Supreme Court has said, like Ashley said, in a case called Brady versus Maryland, and also in a later case called Kyles versus Whitley, that prosecutors are responsible not just for giving information to defense, but also for keeping track of the information. And the court has said that includes information within the possession of police departments or other people involved in the case. And so the prosecutors have a legal obligation to keep track of and to give defendants information that might help the defendant's case by attacking the credibility of the witness.
Rachel, how consistent are these lists? Are the record keeping on these lists from one state to another, one county to another?
Horribly inconsistent. There's really very little law other than what we just talked about telling prosecutors exactly what information they need to keep track of or exactly how they must keep track of it. And so we find just a ton of disparity across the state and even within states. Different counties operate differently. Some prosecutors don't have these lists at all, and it's unclear to me how they would keep up with their legal obligations, but they just don't keep track.
Ashley, what do you see when you look around Wisconsin as far as what Rachel was just talking about, the consistency or lack of same on these Brady lists?
What Rachel said is exactly what we are seeing. Our colleagues at Wisconsin Watch earlier this year had filed records requests with prosecutors in every county in the state. 17 denied the request or said they didn't keep track, and another 23 said they had no names on file. Earlier this year, Milwaukee County DA's office released a partial list, which included officers who had been criminally charged or convicted of a crime. However, when WTMJ4, as well as us at the Journal Sentinel and Wisconsin Watch, as we pushed and asked for the full list, they ultimately released it with the note, "We cannot, you know, guarantee the accuracy of this." And that gets to some of the inconsistency we were just talking about. Some of these names on this list have a person's name, and then it just says integrity violation. It doesn't tell us exactly what happened, what consequences that person faced, or if they're even still employed in that same department or another law enforcement agency.
And Ashley, that takes us to this current effort, now this joint effort with the Journal Sentinel and the two other organizations. What are you trying to accomplish now with this information, especially in Milwaukee County?
At a very basic level, we're trying to first verify the accuracy of the list, as I was just discussing. That's involving all of us from our partner organizations divvying up the work, filing additional public records requests to figure out what exactly landed people on this list and if they are still employed in law enforcement, as well as trying to discern how local police agencies are communicating with the prosecutors and the DA's office and what policies they have about proactively sharing information about officers who have had integrity violations or other concerns that would put their credibility in question.
We're talking about prosecutors' lists of police officers who they question their ability to testify successfully in court. These are called sometimes Brady lists or do not call lists. Our guests are Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Ashley Lutheran and University of St. Thomas law professor Rachel Moran. Rachel, I imagine there's a couple different audiences that might have an interest in these lists. First and foremost, their intended audience, defense attorneys and the people they represent. How forthcoming across the country are prosecutors with these lists when these lists actually exist in the first place?
There's a ton of variety there, too. And I want to be clear, I do think prosecutors are partly responsible for this. I would call it a problem, the lack of consistency. But so are judges, so are lawyers generally, for politicians, for not creating clearer guidelines. So we see just a ton of inconsistency in terms of not just what prosecutors collect, but whether they proactively give the information to defense attorneys. In some states, that's because there are different laws governing whether this information is publicly accessible. So some states say, put really just a tight hold on information about officer misconduct and say it's very hard to give access to the public. Some states say these are public servants, people should have the information, and these are open records. But those differences in laws create a lot of variety in terms of how readily prosecutors disclose the information.
And Rachel, I imagine one argument against making these publicly available is this might be an internal misconduct review or something like that. An officer might not have been charged with a crime, much less prosecuted. Is that one of the arguments that's saying, hey, this is not necessarily information the public has a right to know?
Yeah, that is one of the arguments. And I think that there's a middle ground here in the context of criminal cases where an officer is involved, which is to say, even if the public doesn't have a right to know, certainly the defense attorneys should have ready access to this information. But unfortunately, the way the laws work or the way prosecutors have interpreted them, prosecutors sometimes say, well, we don't think we can even disclose this to the defense attorneys.
Ashley, coming back to this project you're part of now, what is your goal? What information are you hoping to get, and how much are you looking to share publicly?
Our goal is to ultimately publish a database that people can publicly look at this information. We take our job of confirming the information on the list and providing as much context as possible very seriously. There are some other states and some partners on this very project who have done work in other states, reporting in other states that have led to more public disclosures of officers on these so-called Brady lists. For example, in Maricopa County, one of the reporters on this project who works for Scripps, which owns WTMJ Channel 4, his work led to Maricopa County routinely publishing updated lists of officers who are on the Brady list, I think every 2 weeks. And so our goal ultimately is to verify this information, provide a level of accountability and transparency so that the public can see this.
Ashley, what are some of the obstacles, maybe lack of transparency in certain places that's standing between you now at the outset of this project and what you just described as the final product?
I think it's a lot, as I mentioned before, going to a lot of different places and agencies for information, making sure that we are being fair as well. In other states, it has come out as reporters have examined these lists. There have certainly been instances of officers placed on the list when reporters got the underlying information. It did not make sense as to why they were on that list. So we are interested in that as well. And mainly it's an information issue. And frankly, there's also a question of access for knowing who is still in law enforcement. And that kind of gets into a separate issue, but that is something that will be difficult to ascertain and track.
Well, Rachel, that is something that people might be thinking. So wait a minute, we've got some police officers on the job who, for whatever reason, They wouldn't, their testimony wouldn't hold up in court. If people brought up their past behavior, it might be their testimony might be disqualified or at least doubted by jurors. Is there a deeper problem here if there's this roster of whatever percentage of the police force that won't hold up in court?
Yeah, thanks for asking, because that really does get to the heart of the issue. If we have officers who are lacking in credibility, you know, I think a legitimate question is why are they still on the force, or at least why are they in positions where they're involved in criminal cases? So I think this whole Brady list discussion speaks to a bigger issue in police accountability.
Ashley, what is the timeline on this investigation until we might see this public database of officers who might be on these lists?
That is something we are still working through. I can tell you that the media partners in this project are working as efficiently as we can. But as I'm sure you know, at WPR, it takes time to get records requests back and that sort of thing. So I think optimistically, we are hoping for very early next year. You'll see ongoing coverage. We will be highlighting different cases as we get records back on specific individuals. I know WTMJ Channel 4 has aired already one or two stories related to this. We'll have more coming from the Journal Sentinel and Wisconsin Watch as well.
We'll leave it there. Ashley, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Rachel, thanks for being with us.
For sure. Thanks for featuring this.
We've been talking to Rachel Moran, associate professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, and Ashley Lutheran, reporter and deputy investigations editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ashley is part of a multi-team media project looking at prosecutors' lists of police officers who should not be used as court witnesses and trying to share more about an investigation into that list in Milwaukee County. Wisconsin Today, ultra-rare fossils put Waukesha on the map for paleontologists around the world. A trilobite just received a hometown name.
Waukesha aspis is named, of course, after Waukesha, and that's the only place where this is found.
Ancient life under our feet, that's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin is known for a lot of things: cheese, beer, the Packers, and ultra-rare fossils that have caught the attention of paleontologists from across the world.
The Thomas A. Green Geological Museum at UW-Milwaukee was recently designated a geological heritage geocollection, one of only 11 in the world, and we'll learn about this rare collection of fossils.
First, a Wisconsin paleontologist has named an ancient species of trilobite that is unique to and named after Waukesha. It's published in the most recent Journal of Paleontology.
Kenneth Chris Gass is a paleontologist and an honorary curator to the Department of Geology at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Chris, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Trilobites, the state fossil of Wisconsin, you have just named a new species, the Waukesha aspis eatoni. What went into this naming?
Well, the very first part of the name is Waukesha aspis, and that's the genus, which consists of several different species. But in this case, there's only one, and that species is eatoni. The Waukesha aspis is named, of course, after Waukesha, and that's the only place where this is found. And the species name eatoni is after Carrie Eaton from right here at UW in the Geology Museum. She's the curator and did so much for the research that I've done in this and in other aspects of the biota, that it just made perfect sense to name it after her.
You've known about this particular trilobite for quite some time now, but it has never been described. Why is that?
A combination of reasons, some of which I'm not even sure, but I used to be a trilobite researcher myself, a researcher. back in the 70s and 80s. And this was discovered in the 80s, but by that time I'd already gotten into other kinds of things. For whatever reason, there's just so much in the biota that it just got sort of put aside because it's a trilobite. And trilobites are fairly common as a whole. But what's not common is the rest of the stuff that's at the Waukesha biota, and that's the very rarely preserved soft parts and animals that normally don't get preserved at all. So you don't even know that they existed. So this is a very, very big discovery when it was first written up in 1985. And the trilobite was just sort of set aside until now.
So this specimen was collected from an area known as the Waukesha biota. Can you explain what the Waukesha biota is and why it's so significant?
Yeah, the first part of that, what it is, it's an assemblage of animals and other organisms that were alive. That is what a biota is. And the Waukesha biota is a specific one that lived only in Waukesha. What makes it so significant is that it is one of the few, something that's called a Konservat Lagerstätte, which is a German term, but it's used universally for place or an assemblage of fossils that is exceptionally preserved, where it preserves things that normally don't get preserved because it's normally hard parts. So Waukesha biota has soft parts, which, you know, have evaded preservation, evaded detection all this time. So now this is a window to the whole Silurian, this part of the Silurian period that we had never seen before. Instead of just shelly animals like clams and brachiopods and snails and things like that that have shells that fossilize easily, we're seeing skin, eyes, legs, internal organs in Waukesha, which is extremely rare.
Is the Waukesha biota putting Wisconsin on a map as, you know, a really significant place for paleontologists to pay attention to?
I would think that you could say 100% yes on that one. In my opinion, it's the first or second most significant fossil find in the state of Wisconsin. There are other things that are come close, but I would say that this is definitely one of the most significant fossil finds in the state of Wisconsin.
So when you go about naming a fossil and describing it, what are the characteristics of this trilobite? How did you describe it?
Well, like I said, I had a start in Silurian trilobites, the more conventional ones, the ones that didn't preserve any soft parts or whatever. Mm-hmm. This one does preserve the internal organs, well, at least the gut tract. But what it did was it focused me on, like I said, the fact that this hadn't been published since 1985 when it was first mentioned, but not described, not named, not diagnosed or compared with anything else. It was about time that somebody did that. And I was just kind of waiting because I had other things that I was doing. And finally, somebody from Argentina contacted me, a researcher out there who specializes in this family of trilobites. His name was Enrique Randolfi. And he said, would you like to do a paper on that because I find it very interesting, et cetera. So I said, okay, now is the time. Works out perfectly. So we just took it up. And what makes it different is that it's unusual for the family that it's in. It's not a particularly earth-shattering thing mm-hmm. in itself, but there are two things about it that are interesting to me, the abundance of it in some cases. I mean, there are complete specimens that are up to like 40-some or almost 50 specimens on one little area. The trilobites of this family normally have a spine in the back. And it's used normally for, we believe it was used for overturning the animal and some other things, like maybe digging. Well, this one is very different from that because unlike those in the family, this one has an indentation. That indentation, we believe, was used for respiration and possibly even as a little hole through which the antennae could stick through when it rolled up in a ball.
So it could roll up in a ball, but it could still breathe.
It could still breathe. That's an interesting adaptation that this animal had.
You have to do so much sleuthing in this type of work. And it leads me to wonder, why should we care so much what was happening 500 million years ago? How does that inform our modern times?
Change. Everything changes through time. And I've talked about this before, but it does remind us that everything can become extinct. And, of course, you adapt to the environment, or if you don't, you don't make it. And this was one of the things that, of course, applies to us. It applies to every other species around us. And this species and the whole biota, actually, are lucky, very lucky that they were preserved for us. They were not so lucky for themselves, but they were lucky that we were able to find them because it was a very rare preservational environment.
Chris, where does your research take you next?
Well, right now I'm working on 3 or 4 different things. There's a great exposure of rocks out there with fossils called the Milwaukee Formation in Estabrook Park in Milwaukee. And I'm working right now on getting that, getting an international certification for that site. Another thing is, just keep on going, mostly focused on Wisconsin things. That's the most interesting thing to me. This is where I was brought up and raised and educated. And so I've just sort of taken a liking to these things. And one other thing, of course, I'm always going to be going back to is Blackberry Hill, which sort of rivals the Waukesha biota and its importance. It's extremely important.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the update. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's great to be back.
We've been talking with paleontologist Kenneth Chris Gass, honorary curator for the Milwaukee Public Museum, about how Wisconsin has become a hub for rare fossils and the story behind a fossil he recently named the Waukesha Aspis edeni, published in the Journal of Paleontology. Now we turn to a geology museum in Milwaukee that recently received an international distinction for its fossil collection. Robert Graziano is academic program manager of the Department of Geosciences at UW-Milwaukee and chair of the Thomas A. Green Geological Museum Committee. Rob, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So the museum has been designated as a geological heritage geocollection by the International Union of Geological Sciences. What is significant about this designation?
Yeah, we're very excited for this designation. This is recognizing this collection and its international significance to the global paleontology community. This has been a recognized collection in Milwaukee for a number of years, and now we're finally getting some attention for its international significance because the collection was collected at a significant time in the 1860s, 1890s, and in a specific location geographically in Milwaukee down to Chicago area. And that's what's got us this international designation because it's still an intact collection from this unique time period and this unique location.
So the 1860s to 1890s and the namesake of the museum, Thomas A. Green, who was he?
Yeah, Thomas Arnold Green was originally from Rhode Island, but he lived in Milwaukee and his occupation was a druggist of the day. He was owner of a number of things and companies, and he was a partner in the Green and Button Company. And one of the places that he owned was some quarries, and he was able to start collecting fossils from these quarries. And the rumor is he paid his workers to collect some fossils for him. And there was also a rumor that his doctor at one point told him to take up a hobby, and this became his hobby. And he's renowned now as a gentleman paleontologist of the era. He was not a trained paleontologist, but a local person who was interested in collecting local fossils and bartering and trading minerals from different locations.
What did he have a penchant for collecting? What did he love to collect?
Thomas Green collected fossils from the Milwaukee Formation and the Silurian formations of the Milwaukee area and Racine and down to Chicago. And he didn't just collect one specimen at a time. He collected many of the same population from the same location. And it's a set of fossils that allows us to study, for example, the whole population of some specific area. So there's a lot of repetition of, for example, the brachiopods that he collected, but there's an incredibly vast amount of samples, roughly 55,000 fossils and about 12,000 minerals that he bartered and traded with some of the premier mineral traders of the time in the 1800s.
And these holdings are of the, some of the greatest collections of the Silurian reef fossils, I understand. Can you tell us about this reef and the Silurian fossils?
Sure. There is some reefs identified in the Milwaukee area, in particular one in Wauwatosa called the Schoonmaker Reef, that was recognized as the first Silurian Reef, maybe in all of North America, but maybe in all of the world. And it was recognized by some paleontologists of the day, notably James Hall. They came here to identify the structures in this reef and found out that the fossils from this area represented a reef that would be similar to reefs that we see in shallow marine environments today. So that reef right here in Milwaukee is recognized as the first one identified in the paleontological record from that era. And that's what makes it so significant.
How did Green go about collecting these fossils?
Green went to some of these locations himself, and then he had some people with him that would collect them. But he also had the connection of having some people working at the quarries that were able to collect them for him. And when you think of quarrying now, today, we tend to blast and then crunch and grind up rocks to 2-inch or 1-inch size that we need. But back in the day, a lot of that blasting occurred, but then the rocks were broken apart manually with manual labor in the way that some of the workers would have been able to see and recognize these fossils. This is not a process that's done today, and that's why, partly why it's recognized as an irreplaceable collection.
How does this collection then really help to tell our story, the geological story of Wisconsin and the greater Midwest?
This collection is really significant to the Midwest because it's telling the story of the limestones and dolostones of this area, and in particular the Niagara series of dolostones throughout the Midwest that go all the way to Ontario, but they encompass Indiana and Ohio. And this region was, the fossils tell us about the rocks of this region, which indicate that we in Wisconsin were in a shallow marine environment about 400 million years ago, meaning we were, the land that is now Wisconsin was underwater, accumulating sediments in an area south of the equator at about 420 million years ago.
And you've been maintaining and overseeing this collection for over two decades. How has managing the collection changed over the years, and what has evolved? What have you learned?
Yeah, what's interesting is this collection was maintained as a museum when it was donated in 1911 by the Green descendants of Thomas Arnold Green. And it was kind of displayed as more of a museum in the Thomas A. Green Memorial Building until about the 1990s. And in that time, it was moved over to Lapham Hall in UWM, and it's more in a gallery or presentation room. So managing the collection has been really overseeing the gallery and the student staffing. So it's not maintained, per se, like a museum where we have researchers working on it all the time. That hasn't happened since the 80s. And now, with this designation, we feel this we can turn the corner and do more with this collection and have research and outreach and activities with the collection.
And you also are in the effort of digitizing the fossil collection. What would that allow?
Yeah, we about 5 years ago, we got a grant from the IMLS, Institute of Museum and Library Studies, and that allowed us to digitize about a quarter of the specimens of this collection. But the grant ended and the funding ended, and we would still like to do that. And we would, if we could do that, we could distribute this collection, let's say, through the internet and allow paleontology research from around the world to take advantage of these drawers and drawers of fossils that we have. On a side note, I've been down in the collection on and off for 20 years. And every time I show a visitor the collection, I open a drawer and I say, there's dissertations and thesis is waiting to happen. And I open drawers for 20 years. Now that every time I swear I open a new drawer that I haven't seen, there's that many fossils.
Oh, wow. So there are definitely aha moments here and opportunities for researchers the world over to make progress and to really have a deeper knowledge of paleontology.
Yeah, exactly. And that is obviously our hope with the fossils themselves, and our hope with the broader community is to just educate the public about the fossils, what they mean to geologic history, what they mean to geology in general and the study of geology, because there's so many specimens that never see the light of day. There is really now so little viewers and visitors here that we hope to be able to show off this collection much more. And we haven't been able to do that. And now we feel we are turning a corner in this last year.
Part of that education of the public is hosting events. You host Darwin Day events, and you have one coming up?
Yeah, we are now going to be on our fourth annual Darwin Day coming up February 15th of 2025. We'll have a Saturday event from 10 to 3 for the community, a free event. At that event, we bring in lots of partners. So we have people from the Wisconsin Geologic Society, Carroll Moraine Geologic Society, Milwaukee Public Museum, and we set up about 20 tables throughout two buildings. And people can come in and they will absolutely learn something. All ages will learn something and they'll have fun. And the kids will leave a lot of little swag, some rocks and some drawings and things, and maybe some jewelry. But it's just a fun science event to raise awareness for this, for natural sciences in general, but to showcase this unique collection.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Kate.
That was Rob Graziano, Academic Program Manager of the Department of Geosciences at UW-Milwaukee and Chair of the Thomas A. Green Geological Museum Committee. He was with us to talk about the museum's recent designation as a geological heritage geocollection, so far the only of its kind in the U.S. And earlier, we heard from Wisconsin paleontologist Kenneth Chris Gass about naming the Waukesha Aspis Eatonii. That's a new name for an ancient fossil, and why our state is such a treasure trove for fossil preservation.
Still ahead, a project in Appleton tackles the growing problem of loneliness with trained listeners in a community living room.
When we think about who comes into community living room, it's really for everyone because we all need connection.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a trip to a tattoo convention in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee lives up to its nickname as the City of Festivals, as it draws millions of visitors every year. But it's the annual Milwaukee Tattoo Arts Festival that draws more than 200 artists from around the world for 3 days of inking and intrigue. WPR's Corrine Hess takes us on a tour of the festival to meet the tattoo artists and their human canvases.
The sounds of buzzing fills the air as you walk into the Milwaukee Tattoo Festival. Booths showcase unique styles of each artist. Some customers browse, others know exactly what they want. They have traveled hundreds of miles to get inked by their favorite artists.
So funny story, I was in the military for years, went into Playboy, did a lot of TV and film, and I just woke up one morning and my husband's like, what are you doing today? And I was like, I'm going to sell the company and become a tattoo artist. And he was like, okay, let's do it.
That's Michelle Manhart. She gained fame in 2007 when she posed for Playboy, appearing in and out of her U.S. Air Force uniform and also draped with the American flag. Michelle was reprimanded and demoted for the appearance and later quit the military. Now a full-time tattoo artist in southern Georgia, the Milwaukee Festival is one of her annual stops.
So Milwaukee Convention is one of our top favorites. We do it every year unless for some reason, you know, a natural disaster. Even that didn't stop us. We're still like, let's go. The Milwaukee people, don't get me wrong, like I've seen some mean people in Wisconsin, right? The northern attitude. But inside here, I kept in touch with people over the years that I've met. I think it's because we have a common... You know, they don't just come here thinking, oh, what's going on? They come with a purpose. They know, you know, and they're just always so nice. They have so many great ideas. They're very artistic, but they let us have the freedom.
Freedom to tattoo customers with Michelle's signature style of cartoons, portraits, and flowers. A couple of booths over is another artist who made the journey to Milwaukee for the convention.
How you doing? My name is Daryl Cleveland. Everybody call me DJ. I own Moving Murals Art Studio out of Philadelphia. Just here to tattoo, leave my mark on the city. I always knew how to draw, and I went to get a tattoo one day, and the guy didn't know how to draw. And he was like, well, I can't do it until you have a picture. So I sat there and drew the picture, and he tattooed it. And I was like, well, I could have did this. So the next day, I got a machine and been tattooing ever since.
DJ's tattoos are beautiful, detailed line work. He offers clients anything from images to Medusa, to the Joker, to intricate faces of their own children.
Tattooing is fun, but it's like the creation process that's really the fun, you know? Like, just building it, and then, yeah, like, building the tattoo, like, because it starts with just one line, you know? And then by the time it's done, you got magic.
A young Milwaukee woman is getting work done in another booth. It's of one of her favorite Disney characters.
Kara, Kim Packness.
I'm Matt Sorensen.
I met Matt like 10 years ago. My parents live in Davenport. I got tattoos with my dad and my brother from him, and I've been getting tattooed from him ever since. I've always loved The Little Mermaid ever since I was a child, so I actually told Matt about that idea years ago, and he came up with the whole concept, and it's finally coming together.
Swinging back around to Michelle, a large photo of her naked body from her Playboy days is attracting visitors.
So how many tattoos do you have?
I kind of have this personal joke that if you know how many you have, you don't have enough. Because if you can count them, you just don't have enough. They're not flowing together anymore. So I don't know. Like, my entire back is done. I have full sleeves. I have a lot of leg tattoos. But still plenty of room for a lot more. So I really don't know how many. I can show you my favorite one. This is my favorite tattoo. My grandson actually did it on me.
It's a scribble on Michelle's arm.
He has been somewhat in the shop since he was born. And when he was 3 years old, he did his own stencil. He did his own setup, everything all the way through from beginning to end. We just guided him in places where he may have needed things. And he was only three.
WPR's Tattoo List reporter Corrine Hess brought us those voices from the Milwaukee Tattoo Arts Festival. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Last year, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy released an advisory on a public health crisis related to loneliness and isolation in the United States.
He warned of the mental, emotional, and even physical health risks that can come with loneliness.
Also last year, a program in Appleton began offering a local solution to loneliness and isolation. The Community Living Room offered pop-up listening spaces around town, providing peer support and connection for residents. Just last month, the program was finally gifted a permanent space of its own.
The goal is to boost interpersonal connection and improve mental health outcomes for participants.
Karen Iverson-Riggers is a Wisconsin-certified peer specialist, lead trainer of emotional CPR for the state of Wisconsin, and a founding worker and owner of Ebb and Flow Connections Cooperative, which facilitates this community living room project. And Sarah Kohlbeck is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral medicine, director of the Division of Suicide Research and Healing in the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's the academic partner on the Community Living Room Project. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Karen, thanks for being with us.
So glad to be with you.
All right, Karen, talk us through what the Community Living Room looks like, how it works in practice.
Yeah, so Community Living Room is a project of Ebb and Flow Connections Cooperative, and it's really centered on creating connection. So this really came out of recognizing the need in community with folks feeling really lonely and isolated and wanting to create a space that breaks down a lot of the barriers that people often find when seeking support. So there's no appointments needed, no forms. You come in and we welcome you just like I'd welcome you into my living room. We have food, we have beverages, and folks there who are there to listen.
And that's the key to this. If I show up as a participant here, I'm not talking to a therapist, right, who's going to give me advice or prescriptions or cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm going to be talking to someone who's a really good listener. Do I have that right?
That's right. And all the folks who are listeners in our community living room all have their own experience with mental health, substance use, trauma, other adverse experiences. So we've been there. We talk about connection as being seen, heard, and valued just as you are, right? Without judgment, without fixing, without, oh, have you tried? Or as we often do out of our own discomfort to try to kind of silver lining something. We're just there to be present for whatever is present for that person. And sometimes we're laughing together and sometimes we're crying together. Really that gift of human to human connection.
And Karen, who do you have in mind as the participant, people who would take advantage of the service that you're providing here? What do you expect people would be coming in with?
So we say that connection is prevention. So lots of times folks don't reach out until they're really struggling. And often they make that call, right? And they're told like, oh, you have to wait 6 weeks or 3 months for an appointment or to talk to somebody. So the idea of community living room is really to be kind of on that prevention side, right? When you're first struggling or even before you might be struggling and just looking for connection. We need connection as humans. And so when we think about who comes into community living room, it's really for everyone.
Sarah, let's bring you into this. Karen just mentioned that concept. Connection is prevention. Now, I know in a lot of your work, you've done work with specific at-risk groups, farmers, medical professionals, to see what works in suicide prevention. How important a part of our mental, our emotional well-being is just that simple concept of connection?
Yeah. And I guess what I will say is that really connection is the antidote to pain, right? When we are experiencing, you know, whether it's a mental health challenge or some other sort of life challenge, that social connection is the key to really improving, whether it's, you know, health outcomes or, you know, even just the situation that a person is in. We know that social connection from the suicide prevention literature and from the mental health literature is incredibly protective. So I think, you know, with the community living room piece offering that connection sort of in the community in a very accessible way, it's really doing a lot in terms of that upstream prevention for, you know, whether, again, it's a mental health challenge or even suicide.
Karen, you've been doing these living rooms as pop-ups since last year. I understand now it's got its own space in downtown Appleton. I'm really curious how you set the stage, right? How do you make this a setting where people feel comfortable maybe talking to a stranger about something that they're not comfortable talking even to their own friends and loved ones with? How do you make that a good space for that to happen?
Yeah, that's real. And through our experience in doing pop-ups in community, sometimes folks will like point blank say to us, why are you here? What are you doing? And so we'll invite into the space, we'll explain, right? We're just here to listen. And often that shows up, like we don't force any connection. We are just present. And so when you come into our space in downtown Appleton, we've got couches and a rug and lamps and there's food on the table and there's coffee and there's tea and we have warm cookies because warm cookies in the living room, right? And so really that breaking down the barrier of saying that there's really not an expectation of how you have to be here. We're just here to be present with you.
We are talking about the Community Living Room Project. Karen Iverson Riggers is with us, a founding and worker and owner of Ebb and Flow Connections Cooperative. They facilitate this project. Sarah Kolbeck also with us, academic partner on the project, director of the Division of Suicide Research and Healing at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Let's, Karen, talk about listening. And people might hear listening and think, that's easy. We listen all the time. I've learned slowly in my personal professional life that no, listening is a real skill. Can you talk about the kind of training that goes in for the listeners in this project?
Oh, you absolutely put it right, right? We get a lot of training on writing and speaking and reading, and we receive very little facilitation on what it means to really listen. So we have a training that's called emotional CPR or ECPR. So just like you take CPR for your physical heart, ECPR is for supporting folks in emotional distress or crisis. And so it really focuses on a couple of things. One is centering ourselves, like being fully present in the moment and how do we do that and connecting with ourselves. And then also thinking about in listening, how do we connect at the level of emotion? How do we connect with saying, oh, I can identify a time in my life when I felt that way. I can really feel with you. So you might describe it as listening in empathy.
Sarah, you've been through the ECPR training, the emotional CPR training, I understand. What kind of things did you take away from that?
Yeah, it's interesting because as the academic partner on this project, I really wanted to attend the ECPR training just to sort of get a feel for what the training is about, the types of things that are taught as part of the training. And so I went in very much with that academic partner kind of hat on. And I found myself very quickly sort of taking that hat off and becoming an active participant because it really is about making those very, very human connections. And I think one of the things that I learned is if you have had human experiences, if you've experienced grief or loss or sadness or loneliness, you have all of the training and expertise that you need to do this listening. And so it really is about sort of that practice then of that really intentional listening with empathy that Karen mentioned.
Karen, it seems to me there's some lessons here for our everyday lives, not just for the listeners at the community living rooms. Like I'll speak for myself. I've been in that situation. Somebody shares a problem and I want to go right to, well, have you tried blank? Or, hey, things are going to work out okay. How do we get past those sort of responses we go to and give the person what they actually want and need?
Well, those are very human responses,
right? I hope so.
When we care deeply about other people, right, we don't want to see them in pain. Or we see that in community, even somebody we don't know, right? We don't want to see them in pain. And so lots of times out of our own discomfort, we go to like, let me fix it, or let me tell you it's okay, like, or all of those kind of things. And there's something so powerful about just witnessing pain, just being a witness, right? To say like, I see you, and that sounds really hard, or I really don't have any words. I'm just so glad you told me. And often that kind of listening without like fixing, it can be so powerful. We say in our work that pain witnessed is pain transformed. It doesn't fundamentally change anything about what that person is going through, but something fundamentally shifts when we really feel witnessed right where we are.
Karen, this is in Appleton. We're on the radio statewide. Suppose somebody out there is listening thinking, hey, yeah, we need this in our community. What would you say to them to help them steal your idea?
Yes, we would love to see community living room everywhere and accessible for folks. And so one of the pieces is emotional CPR training that we do. We offer that both in person and virtually. So that's accessible to anyone throughout the state. And that's a great way to build some understanding about what this project really means and how we listen. And so we have folks that are in Madison. We have folks that are in Menominee. We have folks in the kind of Lakeshore region, Manitowoc, Sheboygan. We have folks in Green Bay who are all working to build community living room in those communities. So it's really exciting to see this project grow, expand, and I would love to see this everywhere. So everyone has a space to connect.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Karen Iverson-Riggers is a founding worker and owner of Ebb and Flow Connections Cooperative in Appleton. Sarah Kolbeck is director of the Division of Suicide Research and Healing at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We talked to them about Appleton's community living room, a new space for interpersonal connection. We're looking back on 2024 and inviting you to share some of your favorite memories from the year. And today we're looking for your favorite TV shows you watched or the series you couldn't help but binge.
I will say that the feel-good TV and the all-around crowd pleaser in the Kent House is The Great British Baking Show. On a Friday night on the couch with some special sweet treats, you just can't go wrong with that.
We like The Man on the Inside. That was a short series, but pretty fun. Did you make a date with a TV series, or do you plan to catch a TV show during some holiday downtime?
Share with us. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call 888-642-0232 to talk about your best TV shows, the surprises, the old favorites of 2024.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.